After he left the anti-tanks, he had quite a long period in various hospitals with jaundice and, you know, various complaints. And then when he returned to brigade.
And was he then brigade commissar?
No, he was never commissar there. When he came back to brigade, Dave Duran, an American, was the brigade commissar. Slater became Malcolm Dunbar was chief of staff, and Hugh Slater was chief of operations.
Chief of operations.
Yes.
Who was battalion commissar then?
When I was.
Yes.
Tapsell.
Tapsell.
Wally Tapsell. Yeah.
Tapsell. Yes. What I wanted to know was, did Hugh Thomas check that point with you?
No.
Because he just quoted from Copeland.
May I say, Thomas, and in a way I raise my hat to him for being a good salesman, but in my opinion that book was a potboiler, in the sense that he put in the beginning as many acknowledgements as he could, with no sort of detailed checking. And he established the minimum of contact with Alec Diggs, only a brief, who was the secretary of the IBA and to whom he gives one of acknowledgements. As far as I'm concerned, he didn't speak to me.
He didn't check something like that with you?
What?
He didn't check with you?
No, they definitely didn't check. This is lifted from Copeman's book almost word for word.
Good Lord.
Yeah. And, well, I called it a bit of Copemanism.
Well, actually, to do him justice, I mean, I tackled him not on... I didn't mention this, but I said there was some shooting in the battalion. Now, he thought earlier yesterday that this was... He said, now, that was Sam. And what he thought was... I think I get it right, but we can check the tapes. That at this time, correct me if I'm wrong, a lot of Spaniards were included in the battalion after the losses at in the summer campaigns.
Yeah.
And that he said that was because he wasn't there, but he thought that was probably necessary for discipline and so on.
No.
But presumably that's an afterthought.
There was very strong feeling against these two, because it wasn't merely desertion in the sense of going to the rear.
They went forward.
They went forward, and they had details of where our positions were. In other words, it was desertion to the
with
enemy.
With intent. Yeah.
Yes, with intent. But it was definitely so that he had no right to do that. He was in hospital far to the rear. He was no longer anything to do with the battalion, and
that sorted out 1 point.
Yes, right.
Can I just stop there? From Benicassim, where?
From Benicassim, this was as the breakthrough towards Tortosa. The fascist breakthrough towards Tortosa was taking place, so they evacuated the entire hospital up to Mataró, and there...
Did you go by land?
Yes, by land, yes.
So you'd be danger of being cut off?
That's right, yes. So they evacuated, not only the hospitals, the brigade hospitals, but a whole number of other brigade services, and in fact you could say that with the threat of the breakthrough, the whole international brigade, with a few exceptions, was brought north to Barcelona.
In the Catalan sector?
Yes, in the Catalan sector, yes.
And you went then to Barcelona, did you?
No, I never went to Barcelona. I was in Mataró.
Oh, you went through.
Yes, I went through. I don't even remember it. I was in Mataró then for, well, a long period until I was able to be sent home.
And you came home before the rest of the brigade?
Yes.
What did you do then? Once you got back to England, once you recovered?
Well, I went into Middlesex Hospital for a little period. Which came first? Then I was a member of the National Union of Paper Workers, which, besides covering the paper mills where I'd been a chemist, also covered Fleet Street, and they gave me, the union who'd adopted me gave me a card to work in Fleet Street, and I worked there for a few weeks while I was sort of getting strong again. Haldane suggested that I should work with him to re-establish my sort of science basis before looking for a job, but I decided that I didn't want to do that, and I asked the Communist Party whether there was a job for me. And for a few months I worked as the organizer of the what was then the Russia Today Society, which was doing propaganda, and I was working for them at the outbreak of World War II. There's one little incident that's worth putting on record. At that time, there was a submarine called the Thetis, which had sunk in Liverpool on its in Liverpool Bay on its trials, and the whole crew and the experts on board had died because they couldn't use the safety escape apparatus, the escape hatch was jammed up. And so Haldane was carrying out a number of experiments for the Admiralty to find out what had wrong. And he needed a number of helpers, and he had the idea of getting a number of international brigaders to be his guinea pigs. And we went down to Seba Gormans, who are diving equipment experts, and they had a large pressure tank where you could vary the composition of the air. And there was one little thing that amused me intensely. There were all sorts of top brass from the Admiralty, you know, there with gold rings going up their sleeves. And one of them said, before the experiment, said to Haldane, "Well, Professor, what do you want to prove?" Haldane had a very high-pitched, squeaky voice. And he said, "I don't want to prove anything. I want to find out the truth." Anyway, so we all got in this tank. And then the concentration of carbon dioxide and was steadily increased, and Haldane gave me the job of working out a sum involving the percentage, some addition and multiplication, and after a time I found that I was extremely confused and everybody else was confused. I think it was approaching 10% carbon dioxide. I mean, we were gasping, but we were still alive. So we were then taken out of the tank into the fresh air, and I vomited heavily. And he was then able, a number of the bodies that were in the escape hatch, and breathing oxygen, had vomited, taken off their mask inside the escape hatch and had been blocked with bodies, so the other 200 men couldn't use it. And so by this comparatively simple experiment, they made a change in the escape drill. You started breathing oxygen in the submarine with a high carbon dioxide content. But if you wanted to, you vomited inside the submarine, where it didn't matter if you took off your mask. Then you went into the escape hatch and could make your way. And I thought afterwards, well, it was not only a brilliant bit of scientific endeavour, it put the International Brigade very, very much in the public eye.
Just coming back a bit on that, was there any point, probably in recollection or even from whilst you were there, was there any point when you thought that the war was actually lost?
No. The thought, if you like, never entered my head. I mean, I realised we were going back. I realised things were getting increasingly difficult. And I recognised the power of the metal that was being used against us, bombs, artillery, and what you will. But all the time, we had the confidence that non-intervention would be ended and the Republican Army would get adequate supplies. And this was always our sort of hope and our support.
Two sort of international events. First, Czechoslovakia. The British government's, you know, the Munich Agreement. They didn't intervene, they let Germany take over. Did that have any repercussions in Spain?
Yes, we all felt deeply upset and deeply shocked. And if you like, we became more and more anti-Chamberlain. But again, we hoped that the general revulsion of opinion would also, and the fact that more and more people were beginning to see the threat to Britain itself. I mean, Churchill changed his attitude to the Spanish Republic about this time. And again, we hoped that this change in opinion would be enough to compel a change in the government's attitude towards non-intervention. And if the British government had changed, then France would have changed as well. And of course, there were vast supplies waiting in the south of France, which could have been brought into the Republic, given the change of attitude by the French government.
A second point, come back in a moment to the Civil War, the agreement between Germany and Russia just on the outbreak of second, just before the outbreak of the Second World War, how did that affect you, and especially, you know, within the party? Was that a great disappointment when you heard of that pact? Did you think of it simply as a tactical thing on the part of Russia to gain time?
Well, it was very difficult to face up to. But when you were involved in political discussion, we saw it as a tactical move, a move to gain time and an attempt to split what was the big danger, that there would be a front of France, Britain, Italy and Germany against the Soviet Union. At that time I was following international events pretty clearly and pretty closely, and the behaviour of the British government showed that they were not serious in their opposition to fascism. And so it required considerable thought and discussion, but I then was clear and accepted that it was a tactical move.
It did cause a lot of heart searching in the party, did it not?
Definitely, yes. Oh, yes. Yes. Because, also, because we were so anti-fascists, we did not attach sufficient weight to the duplicity and the help which the Chamberlain government was in fact giving to fascism at the time.
Is there any way in which you think the Soviet Union could have been criticised over its handling of, you know, its supplies to the Republic, its help to the Republic? Do you think it did it as much as it could?
In my mind, it did as much as it could. First, it was alone in the world, and it had its own needs, military needs, to prepare for. I mean, whether or not Stalin failed to appreciate the imminence of World War II, I don't know. But certainly there was a general understanding that war against fascism would come sooner or later, and they were building up their own resources. And so the supplies they sent were supplies which did not go to the Red Army. The other consideration, if you look at the map, the only way in which they could be sent to Spain was from the Black Sea through the Dardanelles, where the reports could be, and right across the Mediterranean, which was then not only patrolled by the German Nazi war vessels, but Italian planes and submarines were operating. And so the supplies they sent, or which reached Spain, were only a part of those which set off. Then there was the political problem. The key thing for the Soviet Union in those in that period was before the war, was to avoid diplomatic isolation. And she made repeated attempts to create a front of France, Britain, and the Soviet Union against the threat of Hitler. But, when the proposal was made that this pact should be signed, the British government sent, not by plane, but by a cargo ship, not even by a fast warship, a dugout who had no influence named Admiral Sir Ernie Earl Drax, who's a Dorset landowner. I know the name because that's my home area. And of course, when he got to Moscow, or to Leningrad first of all, and then to Moscow, after a lapse of a considerable number of days, he wasn't treated seriously. And the Soviet government therefore said, right, if we cannot form a peace front with the Western powers, then we'll try to break the front by signing the Soviet-German agreement. And in my opinion, the Soviet Union, its aid was not only material, it was also military, in the sense that a number of the instructors there helped very much in the in training down to battalion level. They helped us to train on the anti-tank guns. But also, they gave political help. Maisky's role in the non-intervention committee, which was meeting in London at that time, was a very positive role. I mean, it would have been easy to adopt a if you like, a sectarian, I have nothing to do with it. But in fact, his speeches and interventions and role in that non-intervention committee helped to expose the part that Mussolini and Hitler were playing in the aid to Franco. Although, of course, we could say it helped and it didn't succeed in breaking the non-intervention committee agreement, which in my opinion was the final stranglehold on the Republic.
One final question on Russia. What was your reaction when you learned, at whatever subsequent date, that quite a number of Russians who had been in Spain were in fact imprisoned or even executed by Stalin on the return to Russia?
Well, we didn't know this until after the 20th Congress. And there was a period of, well, almost physical sickness and fear, because you knew that these men could have provided an invaluable assistance on the basis of their military experience and the lessons learned in Spain. And so therefore, it was, well, it was more than a shock, it was a deep feeling of questioning, and also an understanding that these things must never happen again.
If anything came, not only the Spanish War, but the Second World War, one gets the impression that it's been a far more independent line for the parties in Western Europe. I mean, one takes for example, of France or Italy, and even this country. Would you say that is true now, that there isn't so much as there was, say, in the 20s and 30s, a very, very narrow following of the Moscow line?
Well, definitely. But in those days, we were starry-eyed. We thought that with the victory of the working class, the major problems would disappear, and the problems of building socialism, we more than completely underestimated. We just didn't recognize the problems will be as sharp. And if you like, we failed to be Marxists, because the essence of Marxism is that you look at everything with a critical eye. You take nothing for granted, you don't believe, you question everything, and on the basis of thought and analysis, you say, this is the position. And in those days, Russia could do no wrong.
When you were talking about the idea of the workers' revolution, that was sort of the line of the sort of 20s and early 30s. When the line somewhat shifted about 1935, 36, to the notion of the collaboration in the popular front, did that disillusion people at all, or did they simply accept it, or was it taken as a tactical, useful, practical politics, or how was it taken?
Well, first, this change, which, if you like, received its crystallization in the Seventh World Congress, but in fact had been in process of development. In many countries of the world, in France, in Italy, and certainly in Britain, where a whole number of previously narrow approaches to other people who were sincere in wanting change had begun to break down. But so there was, in the British Communist Party, not only a welcome, but almost a sigh of relief. Yeah. It took us some time to eliminate and see the importance of working on with everyone who would work for us, who would work with us, who was against fascism and was against war. I mean, and they certainly were not eliminated even by the time of the Spanish War. But at least the whole trend in British politics, embracing not only the communists but much, much wider circles, was one of welcome and one of relief, that of the line of, of Dimitrov's speech, if you like, yeah, putting it crudely.
So it was taken more as a sort of a welcomed evolution.
Yes.
Away from the sort of...
Yes, it was. Days. It was. In fact, it was a crystallization of something that had already begun to form.
Yeah. So someone like Trotsky or the boom in Catalonia would have been seen rather more like throwbacks, would they, or someone who really wasn't in touch with what was going on.
Yes, they were. They should have been regarded as people out of touch, but because of the influence of the Soviet Union on the thinking, this sort of feeling of Trotskyism was still thrown around to people who were out of touch with the changes. You see, the anarchists, who were, if you like, even more out of touch than the POOM, but the development of the anarchists in Spain was a development based on reality of war, reality of common struggle, so that the leaders of the FAI, if you like, the philosophers of the big mass anarchist viewpoint, they were compelled, not necessarily because their own views had changed, but because their followers had changed and seen the need for organisation and discipline, production in the factories, that forced socialisation or taking over the land wasn't the immediate step. Mm-hmm. I think if the same approach had been adopted towards the POOM and the provocation which took place in Barcelona had been, that the leaders in any case were taken out and got rid of, and probably correctly. But what happened to the people who were in the POOM battalion? I don't know. I know what happened to four who were in the ILP contingent. They joined up when they went to Barcelona in the May events and saw what was happening. They said, this is not play. We don't want to have anything to do with this ILT lot and the POOM. And they went down the road and joined a Spanish mixed battalion.
The POOM and the CNT and the FAI in the May Rising in Barcelona, they're always portrayed as sort of wide-eyed innocents in some ways. Not so much wide-eyed innocents, but people with a revolutionary fervour who were sort of deceived by the Madrid or Valencia machinations. Would you see them as that?
No. First, we probably may never know the truth about the Barcelona uprising, whether or not there were Gestapo agents or OVRA agents or FBI agents. Having read the, or MI5 agents, but having read the recent news about the CIA, shall we say, that type of activity didn't originate or begin in America, and so I do not discount the possibility that there were fascist agents operating there.
Who started the attack on the...
Well, who incited the attack.
Yeah.
It seemed there is no doubt at all that the anarchist influence in Barcelona and Catalonia was holding up the war effort in many, many ways. And if you like, I'll include a little story later on about that. And therefore, if the Republic was to win, they had to bring Aragon and Catalonia into the war effort. I described that our offensive on Belchite, although it had a military purpose, but it also had a political purpose, because once you start fighting, then you change the whole thinking of attitude of towards, well, towards struggle against fascism. And so whether or not the Valencia government forced the issue, you know, over the telephone exchange,